Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in. What's going on? It's David Summers hosting another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring, back into time. Let's get wall-to-wall and tree-top tall with the Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller, in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. Hey, Ron, I got to say, Studcast have been so good lately. The hidden history lesson on so many different subjects, kayfabe subjects that are never discussed on any other wrestling podcast. They are off the chain. And your new segment on Southeastern Knoxville's history, after you sold out and left, and why the territory was not being successful, I think that is absolutely fascinating. And you do all that in the first part of a Studcast, which we're about to get. So then comes what's happening in the Southeastern Gulf Coast territory in great detail. I think it's one of the best Studcasts there is about wrestling, period.
I appreciate that, and it seems like the fans are enjoying it, Dave, that's for sure, and I want to stay on top of that. I don't get to converse with fans that much anymore, and I'm thinking about using my social media sites to ask some questions. You know, I just want to make sure I find out what people really want to hear, mm-hmm. and if it's something that they're not already getting.
Okay, which I think you do a great job on your social media already. People do ask you a lot of questions and make comments, and they don't necessarily go into great detail. Maybe they're thinking, well, I don't really want to bother this stud, but you really don't mind that, and I think that's what's cool about you. I don't think you've ever done that before. I mean, like what you're talking about, have you, stud?
No, I haven't, man, and I'm considering suggestions from those regular listeners that tune in every week, And they can obviously never have a bad idea, you know. And in fact, I'm going to do that for the first time ever. As soon as this Studcast is going to be released, I'm going to get let listeners feel free to suggest on my post. I'm going to post on the social media sites a little post there that asks them about their thoughts. They can write me and what they tell me what they'd like to hear, you know, and do they enjoy what's going on, and maybe have something that they would like to suggest. I do these Studcasts basically for the fans, and why not find out more about what they want to hear, man, right?
Absolutely. And you know what? As we're headed into the July 4th holiday week and really into it now, a lot of people are going to be on the road, a lot of people traveling the highways, and a lot of people take the time to listen to these Studcasts, or now they've got a lot of free time to do that. So I think you're definitely going to have a lot of listenership and maybe a bunch of new listeners this week. All right, so I really think what you were talking about is a great idea. So speaking of what we want to hear, where are we going to be riding today? How do you set this thing up? How do we get going?
Well, as I mentioned at the end of the last Studcast, All-Star Wrestling had closed up and left Knoxville. The Knoxville War was officially over. And we're no longer going to be talking about their matches because they don't have any matches in Knoxville anymore. And oddly enough, for the first time since the new Southeastern promoters took over, They were going to be no weekly wrestling matches for the Southeastern Company either on this particular week. So we'll find out why that was the case. And also today, when the studcast is released, which is going to be on Wednesday, July 3rd, 2024, we're going to be talking about the Knoxville card on Friday, June 27th, 1980. That's almost exactly 44 years ago to the day from where we are now. And it's going to be headlined by the NWA World Championship match with Harley Race. So today's Hidden History Lesson, we're going to be focusing on setting up the big billboard buy in Birmingham. We were basically at this point looking ahead to November of 1980. That was going to be the opening day for wrestling, Southeastern wrestling in Birmingham. That was coming up about 5 months down the road. And we're going to talk about the tremendous card in Southeastern. We'll be talking about the last week in June of 1980, same week as we're going to be talking about where Harley's up there in Knoxville. We'll be talking about the return of a mystery man. It's going to be facing Ron Bass. Bob Armstrong going after the Stompers title. Me and Rob going to be defending our newly won tag belts against a huge mismatched team, crowning a United States junior heavyweight champion in this one, a new one, and much more. So also we were going to be discussing the TV show to promote that card, the results of the matches, the attendances in the three major markets. After all that, hopefully a learning tree question too, Dave.
All right, cool deal. You're absolutely, this thing is loaded up, Stud. So where do you begin all this? How do we get started?
Well, let's start in Tennessee with the Knoxville card, which was on Friday night, June 27th, 1980. Main event was for the NWA World title. Harley Race was defending against the huge star in Georgia at this point, Mr. Wrestling 2, Johnny Walker. Then for the Southeastern Championship, the champion Dennis Condrey was defending against another huge star from Georgia, been down there for several years, and was really, really over, Tommy Rich. Then in a special attraction tag match, Austin Idol and Kevin Sullivan were going to be facing the Assassins. Then for the TV title, champion Terry Taylor was going to be wrestling against Dutch Mantell. And then there were two additional matches, but I'm dealing with an ad here that I get from my good friend Ed Harrison. Mm-hmm. And it just says that there are going to be two additional matches for this particular card.
Okay, but it doesn't name the contestants?
No, it doesn't name the contestants.
Okay.
I see that's some. That's another one of their problems that I have with.
I see how you post some of those from time to time, and it does say that from time to time, but anyway, or at least for Knoxville. All right, so at least they had six matches this time. So why do you think they had no Coliseum matches like the week before?
I'm going to try to answer that question. You know, I never had an opportunity to ask Barnett or Fred Ward about that. And it really doesn't make sense to me, especially when All-Star Wrestling basically left the city after their last match, which was 2 weeks before this championship match. So the world title match, why the owners didn't run matches both weeks before that card is, to me, a question. What the heck? Why not? Right? So I can understand that the All-Star group not wanting to publicize the fact that they were leaving the Knoxville and Tennessee. Obviously, it meant that Southeastern had basically won this war. And that had to be a blow to their egos. So they're not going to really push that back. So it could be Southeastern management might not have known that All-Star was leaving the first week that they canceled because they didn't advertise it. I'm sure that we're not going to be coming back. So then the week that Southeastern ran their normal show, they didn't run on that week. But on the second week when Southeastern, they ran on the first week when they didn't have to run and wouldn't work as well. But then came along the second week and Southeastern decides not to run any show at all. Now, in my opinion, man, they blew an excellent opportunity to get those abandoned All-Star fans. I guess you, a good way of putting it is they're abandoned. They've lost their wrestling that they're into.
Yeah.
And a good way to get them back in the Coliseum would have been run a card that week before the championship match. So as my father used to tell me, and they had a great way of putting it, he said, they dropped the ball by not running that second week. So then they made an even bigger mistake on the Harley World Title night. We had managed to grow Southeastern to a sellout level on world title cards. It took us a couple of years. It took us about 3 years to do that mm-hmm. once I took over Knoxville. Once we managed to get Southeastern to sell out on a world title card, then I realized that, since we can sell the building out, so I decided to set a standard price for the future NWA championship matches. This started in basically, I think, about 1977, and it went on through 1979. So what I did is this championship match, championship prices, basically. It started with general admission seating. Price went up $1 more than usual for everyone in the general admission seating, which wasn't a big price increase, but it was a little bit of one. And the adults' price just went up from $4 to $5. Children were for $3. That went up $1 to $4. Then the first balcony, it had a first balcony in that building. That went up from $6, $2 to $8. And then all the ringside was at least $10 per seat. There was a golden circle that we started doing every one of these world championship matches. We would have three rows. The first three rows of ringside would be $20 and almost always sold out every time we ever did it.
Wow.
And I had basically learned, Dave, that the higher prices made the event seem to even be more important and worth that extra money.
Yes. Wow. Okay.
So on their Friday night, they only charged, and this was Barnett and Fred Ward's, once they had control here and they were running this, on their Friday night with Harley, they only charged their regular price. They didn't even raise it a single dollar for any of the tickets. They left them at $5 for ringside, $4 for the first balcony, and $3 for adults. Then they had $2 for kids. So, I don't have the results of their matches, but I can tell you that their attendance was only about 3,000 fans with Harley Race on the card and prices at regular price where it was always at. So in my day, once we got it rocking, man, and anything less than 5,000 for a world champion being in town, that was considered a bad night. In fact, I wrestled Harley twice in May of 1979, which was just 1 year and 1 month earlier than this particular match with Harley against Wrestling 2. And then we had 5,000 people in the building for both of those shows. Two of them in 1979 were me against Harley. Both of them had more than 5,000 fans.
Wow, what you were talking about earlier about the prices for admission, you're right. It does make it seem like a more important event. Oh, so listen, they only had about half as many people as you normally drew for world title events, and their ticket price was about half of what yours was. So this comparison really says everything about what was happening in Knoxville. All right, are you ready to give us some hidden history describing the billboard buy to get Birmingham off to a great start?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's about as much as we can cover in Knoxville there, and we'll be doing that again each week, covering at least their card and talking about how they're handling business. So, yeah, I was one of the few, if not the only wrestling company in the world to buy outdoor billboards. Mm-hmm. And to me, they were a unique form of advertising. They provided to me a higher profile and an image that most other forms of advertising just didn't give you. And I doubt fans will ever hear anything about this kind of advertising on any other wrestling podcast in the world, because it just wasn't done basically by anybody else, or no one that I know of. And I know talking about this 5 months before the first night of the matches in Birmingham, that maybe seems like a long time in advance, but I had to be setting up billboard buys. You know, I'd been doing this since 1976. In my second year as an owner in Knoxville, I started doing billboards. And this was going to be my third major billboard buy. And actually, this one was done far enough in advance, just barely far enough in advance to make it happen. Take some time to work with a billboard company. And so we were right on the edge of not being able to get this billboard buy in. So the only reason it did, was because I'd made several substantial billboard buys from Lamar. So they went out of their way to make this work for me, even though it was right at the edge of the time frame to be able to get it in. And I'd made several buys from them in 5 years, over a 5 year period of time since I had been starting and promoting wrestling.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I felt like billboards, even though they were relatively expensive, when they were placed properly along driving routes that could be read easily, they produced a higher profile of image for your product than any other advertising that I ever dealt with. And especially since it was wrestling, it was going to put Southeastern wrestling in a class of its own. The mere fact that we're going to run billboards in the Birmingham area within 40 miles, that said a lot about our commitment, and it also set us apart from all the other promotions that have been there.
Absolutely. It reminds me about, as in my mind, going back to Knoxville. You had one particular billboard that was, remind me, was it at an interchange of two interstates? You had one that was like in the best possible place on the interstate.
Yeah. In fact, on that particular billboard, that was one of the first billboards that Lamar ever did, freeway billboard. It was at Interstate 40, Interstate 75 connected right there in Knoxville.
Yeah.
And this was right in that connection and that junction there. And we had an extension that the legs of it was a suplex, a guy giving to guy a suplex. Legs of the wrestler came out the top of the billboard.
Yeah, yeah.
They had never done that before. I suggested that to them, and they went, "Wow, we could do that."
Yeah.
It was really, really something that I really thought was a fantastic way to advertise your company.
And the thing is, you already had a relationship with Lamar Outdoor Advertising, which made it so easy for them to work with you and for you to work with them. So I definitely agree with everything you're talking about there. The last place you would expect to see a wrestling company advertised would be on a billboard. You sort of laid the groundwork for all of that in Knoxville. And I remember not long ago that you talked about doing this in Birmingham. So how many billboards were you going to buy? You said you were going to spread it out like maybe 40 miles.
Yeah, this was probably considered a big buy. For any type of business. I don't care who it was. So we were going to buy 75 billboards. And in the deal, we were going to get 25 free. It were going to be all of them in Birmingham and out at the surrounding cities within 40 miles of the city limits of Birmingham.
Yeah.
So we were also getting them for 2 months rather than only 1 month, which was every other customer. Normally, you got a billboard buy for 1 month. We got this one for 2 months. We got an extra month free.
Were these paper billboards?
Yeah, these were paper billboards back in those days. Yep, they were all paper. And,
wow.
And they were the regular, smaller size billboards.
Yeah. So I mean, that's a lot of billboards. But what kind of chunk of change was that? How much did that cost?
Well, it wasn't cheap. Like I said, billboards were fairly expensive. We spent $20,000, but it was going to give us an instant impact and a powerful image that was going to instantly separate us from all the other wrestling companies that had ever been there. And hopefully it was going to produce us a sellout on the opening night and far beyond that, too.
Okay, so I remember the studcast a while back where you were dealing with the general manager of the Birmingham TV station where your TV show was going to be on. You told him about this billboard buy and that you were going to be putting his call letters on there. And at that time, and the time of the TV show on every billboard for free. And he was ecstatic about that.
He certainly was, right? And good memory, man. And do you still remember the large number of 30-second spots that he gave us right there? As soon as I told him about, I'm going to give you these billboards, he said, I'm going to give you spots. And so he was going to run spots for us promoting our opening night event, November 13th, 1980.
Wow. A generous number, as I remember. And that's all about relationships, the relationship you had with the billboard company, which carried over to the TV station. That is so cool. That's business.
Yeah. And it made a lot of sense because of what he gave us was probably going to be worth $10,000 basically for free.
Sure.
All these spots that he's going to run to promote this opening night. And so that meant the $20,000 buy for the billboards actually was going to be around $10,000 because we're going to get $10,000 free advertising from the TV station. So, it worked out good for the TV station, worked out great for us and great for the wrestling fans in Birmingham. And that was the beauty of billboards. So you could negotiate the price down with the billboard company, and then you could co-op with some partners for additional savings. So there was no way you were going to do that type of deal with a newspaper company anywhere in the country. And, you know, another great thing about dealing with billboard companies is if you made a big enough buy, you could handpick many of the billboards where your signs were going to be located. So the best boards were obviously in those high traffic volume areas, like the one you just brought up, the two freeways coming together in Knoxville. Wow, the traffic there was just amazing. You had a lot of volume if you had a lot of cars there. And then you got to look close to where they were being located and being able to see the board. You know, you took a look at books, the boards, and if they were had these long reads, and which was a long way away from the billboard, you could start reading it. And it, you could read all of it and see it very easily before you passed it. So I was going to be riding billboards all day. On my one day off the week that I set up this deal, I was going to be in Birmingham riding billboards.
That's cool. Very interesting. Having never dealt with an outdoor advertising company like that. So I know what it means, but what do you mean for others who don't? What does it mean riding billboards?
Well, I was going to be going to Birmingham, and I was going to be having to go early. I was going to spend the night there, go early and spend the night, get up the next day at dawn and get into a billboard company car with an employee that was his job to take you around. We were going to crisscross Birmingham and some of the surrounding areas outside the city limits in that 40-mile basis circle that we had basically drawn around Birmingham. And I was going to be choosing the best billboard locations possible. So this was going to be my last billboard buy in wrestling. The next time I was going to buy and visit Lamar Outdoor Advertising was going to be 9 years later, and it was going to be in Nashville. And I was no longer going to be in wrestling. I would have finished my last wrestling company, USA, but by then I was going to be in the hockey business. And I wasn't going to be looking at these little small billboards. I was going to be looking at giant freeway billboards only. And back in those days where we're talking about, there was no giant freeway billboards. They hadn't even thought of doing the giant billboards yet. So it was a different day and time. And there was kind of a silver lining in all this, Dave, about having to go there and spend the night and everything. because I was able to go and spend the night with my cousin Jimmy Golden. He lived in Birmingham at this point. He had not seen him in almost 3 months, basically since the night he injured his back in Mobile so badly that he had to give up the sport.
Wow.
And he was living in Hoover, Alabama, which is just south of Birmingham. And he was running a gas station for his father, who owned the gas station.
Okay, I've been wondering what happened to Jimmy, especially since the injury. It sounds like a pretty good deal for him working with his father. So how was he doing after that horrible injury, and what is the connection to Hoover, Alabama? His father was not from Hoover, was he?
No. Bill Golden, his father's name was Bill. Bill was a Dyersburg guy, just like a whole lot of the Welches. We had been there. Basically, Roy went there in probably the 1930s, and all the wrestlers were trained out of there for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And Bill had been working as a promoter for Roy and down in Alabama, basically out of the Montgomery area. But he had gotten the gas station business. He had one in Dyersburg, and he bought a station that was in Hoover. And basically, Jimmy was living up there in Tennessee to start with. And when Bill bought the station in down there in Hoover, he sent Jimmy down there to run that station because he had been working with Bill for a couple of months, and Jimmy knew how it all worked. And so it worked out good for his dad. It worked out great for Jimmy. And this worked out good for me, you know, because I had an opportunity to see him. And so Jimmy was still having problems with his back, and he was searching for a chiropractor or a physical therapist, somebody that was really good that could help him just to be able to just get around.
Yeah.
He was not healthy at this point. He was still having horrible back problems. And he was glad to hear that we were coming to Birmingham, you know, and we kept him abreast of what was going on. Well, he got his dividends, even though he wasn't able to wrestle in the company. And so he was hoping to come see us. And all the boys, all the guys in the crew, you know, starting when we came there on Monday nights in November. So it was a very sad, it was very sad seeing him, man, not able anymore to do what he loved so much. He really missed the sport, and we talked about it a lot, and I felt really bad about that part of it.
Wow, I kind of hate we couldn't end the first part of this studcast on a better note. It has been extremely interesting up to now, hearing about the Knoxville World Title card and the fascinating billboard buy. Even though Jimmy was a heel when he got hurt, fans everywhere had fond memories of him, no doubt. Before we do the break, can you set us up with the Southeastern Gulf Coast card for the last week in June as we go back to 1980?
Yeah, sure, man. I certainly can. And this was another really good card, man. With all the match combinations that we've been using for the past like 3 or 4 weeks, every match got changed. The people were all wrestling somebody different in one way or another. The opening match was Charlie Cook. He was going to be facing off with the returning hometown big time baby face down there in that part of the country. Ricky Gibson was coming home. So first match, Charlie Cook against Ricky Gibson. And then there was a special challenge match. After what had happened last week in that match with Tony Charles against Sweet Brown Sugar, that ended up with Brown Sugar and Norvell Austin fighting out of the ring and all around the arena and back to the dressing room. And so there was a special challenge match coming up on the second match of the night. Sweet Brown Sugar was going up against Norvell Austin. For the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship, Tony Charles was going to be defending this time against Jerry Stubbs. And then the next match was a Southeastern Tag Championship match. The new champions, Rob and I, had just won the titles from Randy Rose and Dr. Bill Irwin on the last week that we had wrestled. Randy Rose is going to be teaming up with the 6'10", 430-pound Cowboy Frazier. So there was another special challenge match on this card. Ron Bass, who was managed by the Big C, was going to be taking on a mystery partner. You know, two challenge matches, one between two guys that really don't like each other, Norvell Austin and Sweet Brown Sugar, and the other one with Ron Bass, not knowing who he's going to be wrestling, other than just it's a mystery partner. Mystery man. And in the last match, Mongolian Stomper going to be defending his Southeastern Championship against Bob Armstrong.
That is awesome. After all these great cards we've been having, I have a feeling this one is going to be loaded with surprises. All right, before the break, a quick footnote. What was Jimmy able to do if he was managing and running a gas station in Hoover? What was he able to tell me what that was like for him?
Oh, you know, we discussed it. We talked about that a lot. You know, I was asking, obviously, how do you like this? What's this like for you? Well, it's a, you know, there's no sport. There's no business like wrestling business. And, you know, so he'd been wrestling for since he'd been 20 years old.
Sure.
Yep. And, you know, this was like a huge difference. Of vocation or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
It just was totally different. He said, Ron, it's very confining, man. He was working. He told me he was working 16 hours a day. You know? He only had one employee that helped him with the station. Yeah. And that employee would come in and take care of it. Take care of business and give Jimmy that 8-hour break, and he was back there at work again. But he didn't like it.
Right. But physically, with his back ailment, he was still able to do what needed to be done.
Yeah, he was able to get through it, but he was still having the big problems because he had not been able to take off because of that type of job.
Yeah,
he was continually having to bend over and to do things with his back that was making life difficult for him. He was having a very hard time, man. Felt really sorry for him.
Wow, that's tough. From as you said, doing what he was doing, and one of the superstars of your company, as a matter of fact, to I hate to say, be relegated to doing that, because any work is honorable. All right, listen, and so obviously. And that he was still looking for a chiropractor and still working on his back situation. All right, folks, when we return, we will hopefully, on the TV show, find out who the mystery man is and more as this Studcast continues. Stay with us. All right, Studcast fans, on the break, Ron, let's talk about what you're going to be doing in Ozark, Alabama. That is only maybe 25 miles north of Dothan on Highway 231. So Ozark Civic Center is going to be a big night. It's going to be Saturday the 13th. Tell me what's happening at the Ozark Civic Center.
Yeah, we're just about a couple of weeks away from it, man. And, you know, I was there in March, I believe it was, and I'm going back again. They got another great card. They got a lot of great young wrestlers there in that company. And I was really, really impressed with what I saw when I went last time. And they asked me to come back again, and I was very happy to do that. And I'm looking very forward to it. Seeing a lot of fans in that part of the country. We had a great deal of them show up last time. And I'm sure there are going to be a lot of them come back again this time. And I'm going to bring along some souvenirs, and I'll be doing a meet and greet. I think they open their doors at 6 o'clock, and the matches start at 7. And I'll be out there basically from 6 o'clock, maybe to 8 o'clock or something like that, as long as it takes to say hello to everybody and bring in a bunch of pictures. And I'm bringing my USA Championship belt. People can have their photo made with the belt. And, you know, I'm just looking forward to seeing a lot of those people in that part of the country again.
Oh, cool. Are you going to be stepping up into the ring? Anything happening?
I don't know. Now, I ended up last time getting highly involved. I did not expect to end up doing what I did. But, I don't know whether I'm going to end up dealing with the same type of situation as last time or not. But it was a little bit awkward, something I hadn't done in a while. But, So you do what you got to do, right? So and you know, there's a lot of guys, there's a lot of those young guys, man, that don't have the proper respect sometimes. And I think it's good sometimes to show them what it's all about.
You know, you sound like Al Pacino. I'm trying to get out, but they keep pulling me back in. All right. So Saturday the 13th, we're only from today, we're only about 10 days out as we approach July 4th. So I'm really looking forward to that. Yeah, tell me the time and how they can see you again.
Okay. Like I said, it's going to open. The gates open at 6 o'clock, and I will be available starting at 6 o'clock. Then matches start at 7, and Dave, I got to talk about, man, they're telling me that Elvis is going to be singing the national anthem for this, you know, and I think I can't hardly wait to see that. That's a good buddy of yours, you know, Jerome Jackson down there, that's his home, Ozark, and
Wow,
he's a big famous Elvis impersonator. That should be a great way to open the show.
Well, don't pretend like you're not personal friends with the king. He is the king. We've had lunch with Jerome a few times over the years.
I know Jerome well, man.
Indeed. If you've never seen Jerome Jackson do his thing, I know you're going to enjoy that. Okay, Ozark, Alabama. It is Saturday, July 13th. All right, let's get into the second half of this studcast. If it's anything like the first half, you know it's going to be a barn burner. Okay, with as good a card as you talked about before the break, and I mean it was a really good one, I can only imagine how good this TV show, promoting it and setting it all up, is going to be. So how did the TV show open up, Ron?
It opened with Bob Armstrong, and he had his TV trophy with him. He was at the set with Charlie Platt. Charlie basically wasn't expecting it. He didn't know Bob was going to come out. And he certainly didn't know he was going to be bringing the TV trophy. So Bob immediately told him kind of what was going on, why he had his TV trophy with him. And so Bob told him he was glad to, you know, Charlie said, you know, what's with the TV trophy, Bob? And so Bob told him, you know, that he'd be glad to explain it. But first he said he wanted everyone to see what happened to him. Last week in the bull rope match, he had a bull rope match with Ron Batts, first bull rope match Southeastern had ever had. Charlie knew the video, was up there in the control room, and he asked the director to go ahead and run the video. So Bob started describing the action. And both men were, these were always bloody matches, these bull rope matches, because of that big old bell in the middle, man. And you got whacked with that bell, and you were going to be busted up. So both guys were already bleeding when the video started, and Bob began to pull Bass around the ring with the bull rope. And he pulled him around the ring one time. You had to pull him around to win the match. You had to drag him around the ring twice, touch all four turnbuckles each time he went around. He had gotten around one time with all the four turnbuckles. And then the Big C jumped up on the apron of the ring, close to where Bob was, dragging Bass around. And the referee was right there checking out Bass, because Bass was, he was bloody, and obviously referee wanted to find out if he could still go on far enough to be dragged any further. And so referee was paying attention to Bass, so Bob just snatched the Big C, and he flung him over the top rope, and the Big C came down on top of the referee, and the referee went down on top of Bass. So the Big C, once he landed on the referee's back, he collapsed the referee on top of Bass, and Bob started working on the Big C. And the Stomper, who had no reason at all to be anywhere near the ring, he wasn't involved in this at all, but he saw what happened, and he saw that the referee was down, and he came to the ring, and he attacked Bob from behind. And he grabbed the bull rope, And he took that giant steel bell that was attached to the center of the bull rope, and he hit Bob in the head with it, and knocked him out. And that was it for Bob. Stomper then he grabbed Big C, who was, you know, trying to get off of the referee, and he threw Big C over his shoulder, and he ran with him back to the dressing room. He wasn't ever even seen by the referee. So Bass regained his feet. at that point, and about the same time as the ref. And Bass sees Bob laying there. So what's he going to do? He just starts pulling him around the ring. He pulled him around all four turnbuckles twice, and he got his hand raised. He was declared the winner. So, you know, Charlie was shocked at what he just saw, you know. Just like the studio crowd was, they had never seen this video before. They'd never seen this match before. So they were shocked, and they started booing in the video just like the match was live, like it was just happening. So then Charlie asked Bob, he said, well, what does this have to do with the TV trophy? So Bob said, you know, he said, I talked to Commissioner Don Curtis, and he said they sent him a copy of the video. And I talked to him afterward, and he said, because the Stomper got involved in the match, you know, I asked Don Curtis if I could have a match with the Stomper. And so Bob said, he told Curtis, then he said, I want to have a championship match with the Stomper. So Curtis said, you know, he felt like he'd allow him to have a match with him. But, you know, he said, I'd have to get Big C's permission to make it a championship match, you know. And so then Bob asked the Big C at that point to come out to the set. Because basically Curtis has said, hey, if you can get the Big C to go for it, then I'll make it a championship match. So Big C came to the set. Big C, he was real eager to get to the set because he started complaining about this mystery wrestler that that Ron Bass has to wrestle. And he was more concerned about the mystery wrestler. Who is this guy? He wanted to know, who is this mystery wrestler? Why is it you can't tell me who Bass is wrestling? So Bob changed the subject quickly, back to trying to, you know, get Big C to talk to Big C about why he wanted him to come to the set. So, you know, about he wanted to make a proposal to the Big C. And the proposal was that he said, I'll put up my TV trophy on the line today. I'll defend my TV trophy today against your Mongolian Stomper if you give me a chance to once again, it'll give your Stomper a chance to once again hold both the trophies, the TV trophy and the Southeastern Championship, you know. And if the Big C would put up the Southeastern belt on the line, all you need to do, tell me that you'll put up give me a match for the Southeastern Championship, and I'll give him a match today for the TV Championship. So, you know, pretty good deal he was asking for. The Big Z, though, he acted like he didn't even hear what he was saying. He went right back to Charlie, and he says, now, who is this mystery wrestler? He was like ignoring him, right? Bob's little Bob's challenge he had made. And so he said, who is Bass facing? I want to know. Tell me who it is, Charlie. So Charlie had not been told who it was. Charlie didn't even know who he was. And so he told Big C that. He said, I don't know who it is. I don't even know who it is. So Bob saw his chance. Now, Big C is just really hung up on this. So he said to the Big C, he says, I know who the mystery wrestler is. He says, if you guarantee me a Southeastern Championship match against your Stomper next week, he said, I'll put up the TV trophy like I just said I would. And I'll also make sure you know who this mystery wrestler is before the TV show ends.
Hmm.
So the Big C was like, wow, okay. So he jumped at it. He said, yeah, I'll take care of it. I'll do that. So he started telling Charlie that he agreed to let his Stomper defend the Southeastern Championship one time, only one time in the coming week against Bob Armstrong. And he says, that's only if Armstrong agrees to give the Stomper a shot at winning back his TV trophy today. And he makes absolutely sure before the end of this TV show today that I know who the mystery wrestler is that's going to be wrestling against Bass this next week. TV studio pop. That's a great deal for everybody. They're going to get him a TV championship match. So they were happy with that, and so was Bob. So the Big C left the set, and Charlie changed the TV format. right now, Shane, put that TV trophy match as the last match on the show, and everybody was happy.
All right, cool deal. That's a great opening to a TV show, by the way. Adding a championship TV trophy match to the end of the show. So who was wrestling in the first TV match?
Well, I was Big Ron Bass, you know. So he and the Big C, they were all smiles, you know, coming out, getting in the ring and everything until the bell rang. And that's when, you know, Bass was always a tough opponent, but he was just a natural bully, man. And he I guess he probably was that way all his life. He was so big, you know. And so he, once the bell rang, didn't take him long, man. He left his opponent laying. He gave him one of those Texas stampedes, man. He threw him over his shoulder and ran him into the turnbuckles upside down, then turned around, ran across the ring, and he dived on top of him. And with that 300-plus pounds, that was the end for that dude. And he had ended a lot of guys' careers with that one.
Wow, that's what a great finish right there. I felt sorry for the guys who had that done to them. All right, how about the second segment on the TV show?
Well, Rob and I opened up at the set with Charlie, and we watched our victory from the week before when we won back the Southeastern belts from Randy Rose and Dr. Bill Irwin, and we ended up beating Dr. Bill Irwin, and it was one of those, the loser of the fall had to leave Southeastern, and so Dr. Bill, he was gone. By the time this show was airing, Dr. Bill was no longer in Southeastern Wrestling. So joined Charlie, we at the set because we wanted going to get a look. Charlie said, "You want to get a look at these opponents, your first opponents, since you won the belt back?" And we were like, "Well, yeah, okay, sure." So the TV audience was a bit shocked, man. But they seemed unimpressed with the new team they were seeing. They let them know that with a bunch of boos, you know. And this new team that they were going to be dealing with, weighed of over 700 pounds, man. And it was the former champion, Randy Rose, and he had joined forces with the 6'10", 430-pound overall wearing Bob Boy Frazier, and Frazier had his valet Floyd, who was also wearing overalls, in the corner.
What a pair.
What a pair, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so that's an odd team. What an odd team. That really had to be. All right, so what kind of match did they have?
Actually, man, they had a pretty darn good match. They made a good team. Rose was a smooth worker, man, and he was especially good in tag matches. He was one of the best tag match wrestlers that I ever saw, and he carried the action, man. And every time Frazier got in the ring, the studio crowd would kind of get quiet because they were anticipating, what's he going to do, this big son of a gun? So the best part of the match was the ending of the match. And Randy Rose, as every time he had an opportunity or every time he wrestled somebody on TV, he hit this guy with another one of those crazy clotheslines, man, that turned him a flip, and the guy landed on his back. And then he just walked over and tagged in the Behemoth. Plowboy came in, and he got a big ooh from the studio because he went running into the ropes as best he could, jumped as high as he could, and he squashed his opponent into the mat. He covered him up entirely. All you could see was the guy's hands and feet sticking out, Plowboy on top of it. And so got the win, obviously, and old Floyd bounced up in the ring and raised their hands. And well, at this point, they got themselves a good cascade of boos from the crowd.
All right, so are we close to personality profile? I mean, they've been really good lately. Set that up for us.
Well, someone fans had begun to change their minds about was involved in this one. It was Norvell Austin, and it was his first time ever on a personality profile alone. And he and Charlie talk briefly about his interrupting last week's profile to warn Tony Charles about his next opponent, Sweet Brown Sugar. Norvell had interrupted the last profile, and he basically wanted to let Tony Charles know that, hey, you're wrestling a guy here you need to know a little bit about. So Norvell apologized for having interrupted it, and then they watched this United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match from the week before. What an unreal match it was. And Sweet Brown Sugar it was his first week in the territory. He was wrestling for the United States Junior Championship, his first night in. And he surprised everybody except Norvell by winning he won the championship belt from Tony Charles. But thanks to Norvell, he didn't get to leave the ring with it. He actually won the match, got his hand raised. But he wasn't able to leave the ring with it because the decision was reversed. Because Norvell came in the ring and the referee, Sweet Brown Sugar, had been choking Tony Charles half the match with a little, probably 2 foot long piece of rope that he had hidden in the back of his trunks. And he would pull it out when the referee couldn't see him, wasn't watching, and stick it around Tony's neck. And at the end of this match, he actually won by getting that rope around his throat again, and then putting what looked to be a sleeper hold on him. And so the referee thought that he had put Tony Charles to sleep with a sleeper hold, and he'd actually choked him out. So the belt was given back to Tony Charles when Norvell got involved. Norvell reached over and snatched the rope out of the back of Sweet Brown Sugar's and then he showed it to the ref, and the referee's like, wow, he rang the bell again. He raised Tony's hand. And so Sweet Brown Sugar and Norvell got into it right then. And they fought all over the arena. And then they fought back to Brown Sugar's dressing room. So Charlie took over at that point. Norvell had been telling the story. And then he had, as he had done earlier in the day, he said he had an opportunity to talk to Sweet Brown Sugar. And he asked him some questions about this horrible relationship between him and Norvell Austin. And he said, if you don't mind, Norvell, I want to play that tape for you. Norvell obviously wanted to see it. So Sweet Brown Sugar, he was extremely upset in the tape. You know, he's talking about, hey, my first week here, you know, I won the United States Junior Championship right in the middle of the ring. And because of one guy, I didn't get my belt. He says, you know, and he said, you know, he said that he said that Norvell hates me because he's jealous of my ability in the ring. He's just not the wrestler I am. And he would wishes he was. And he goes, you know, and he was trying, basically, he said, I think he wants to ruin my career. I was the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, and he caused me to lose it. Just as quickly as I had won it. So he says, but now it's the second week I'm here. And he goes, I got exactly who I want in the ring this next time. And that's going to be Norvell Austin. And I'm going to take care of Norvell Austin for good this time. So Norvell, he could hardly wait to answer those questions, the comments, you know. And he told Charlie the story. He said, you know, Charlie, 2 years ago, Brown Sugar stole a belt from me in the northwestern part of America up there, actually in the Oregon territory. And he said, he almost killed me during that match, using a piece of rope hidden in his tights, just like in this match we just saw with Tony Charles. And he said, that was out of the sport. He said, for almost two years, I couldn't wrestle anymore. So, and he said, now that Sweet Brown Sugar has done shown up here, he says, I'm going to change his name. He said, he's not going to be Sweet Brown Sugar any longer. He's going to be Sorry Brown Sugar.
All right. So another great personality profile. It seems like these two were going to have some serious matches down the road. All right. Who is in the next TV segment?
Well, before it got started, the Big C visited the set again, and he demanded to know who's the mystery wrestler? He goes, Bob Armstrong hasn't told me yet, and he sent no message, and he demanded to know what had happened, what's going to happen here. He promised at the opening of the show that the mystery wrestler's name was going to be revealed to me and Bass, and so he said Charlie still didn't have anything to tell him because he didn't know, and so, you know, Big C had to go leave the set, and he was pretty darn upset about it. Well, the wrestler in the next match was a very popular guy, man. Wow, really, really over as a babyface, Jerry Stubbs. And he had only been back in Southeastern for 3 weeks at this point. And he was going to be in the ring with his upcoming opponent the next week. Was going to be the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, Tony Charles. So Tony Charles came to the set, you know, and he and Stubbs were kind of friends. And Tony was very complimentary first to Norvell Austin, and he gave Austin credit for saving him. Not only saving his belt, he said, but I think he may have saved my life, Charlie. You know, he said, the guy was going to kill me. You know, and he said he had never in his career ever experienced anything like that, what Brown Sugar did to him in that last match. You know, he was like, wow, this was crazy. So Jerry Stubbs, you know, he was showing his great wrestling skills, man. And he was a super wrestler, Jerry. And as the conversation was going on between Tony and Charlie, Stubbs was doing his thing. And Tony was also complimentary Stubbs. And he basically said he is always a pleasure defending against a young guy like Jerry Stubbs. He goes, really, the guy's a great wrestler. I love wrestling him. And about that time, Stubbs won the match, and he beat the guy with a beautiful sunset flip from the ring apron over the top rope and down the guy's back and pinned him.
Wow, okay. All right, was it time for the TV trophy match arranged at the beginning of the show?
Yep, Bob Armstrong came to the ring first. He had brought the giant TV trophy, set it in the middle of the ring, got a standing ovation from the studio audience, and Big C and Stomper came out of the dressing room. Big C sent the Stomper into the ring. The announcer introduced both of them, rang the bell, and the Big C never went. He just went straight on to the set with Charlie Platt. And this time he was more than angry. He was screaming. He was screaming that he still hadn't been told who the mystery wrestler for Ron Bass next week. And Charlie kept reminding Big C that Bob promised. He promised you that you would know before the show was over. So the Stomper and Armstrong, they were already tearing into each other, man. Studio fans were going crazy. And so the Big C was going crazy, too, now that he was finding out that, hey, what is going on here? So, you know, he said, hey, he's lied to me, you know, and he said that Armstrong, you know, could get his hands on the Stomper's belt now. You know, he's got that match coming. He goes, so he said, and then he got hammering on the desk, and he said, I know exactly how to take care of this. And he jumped up from the set, and he went back to the dressing room and disappeared inside. And Armstrong, about that time, put the sleeper hold on the Stomper. And then suddenly here came big old Ron Bass out of the dressing room. He shot up into the ring, and he nailed Armstrong to the back of the head. And then him and Stomper started putting the boots to Bob. Bell was ringing, stopped the match. It was a disqualification. And as you can imagine, it was pretty much pandemonium in the studio. And then the mystery man made his appearance. And the mystery man was none other than Joe LeDuc. He'd not been seen in Southeastern for 10 weeks since Ron Bass hit him with that bell on his bull rope 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
Gave him two concussions back to back. So he'd been gone for 10 weeks. So, man, I mean, the roof lifted off that building. Wow. The fans were going crazy. And obviously, Joe LeDuc went straight for Ron Bass. And Bass and the Stomper headed for the dressing room.
Yeah, I bet they did. What a TV show. That's how you do it right there. I got to say, I probably missed this one because how could anybody forget it? All right. So how about the arenas the next week? What happened there?
Well, the returning Ricky Gibson and Charlie Cook, they had a classic babyface match. I watched it, man. 15-minute time limit draw. Everybody in the building was standing at the end of that match. They were really, really into it. Special challenge match between Sweet Bound Sugar and Norvell Austin was truly a special match, man. It was one of the first times in Southeastern history that both wrestlers ended up bloody in only the second match on the card. I mean, that never happened. These two guys just did not like each other. And there was no winner except the crowd. I mean, the crowd was the winner, man. They got to see a wild match with two guys that they were going to be having a lot of these. The United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match was next between Tony Charles and Jerry Stubbs. And this match stole the show, man. There wasn't anybody in that building that was remotely prepared for what happened. Jerry Stubbs turned heel, man, and he won the United States Junior Heavyweight belt right in the middle of the ring from Tony Charles.
Wow.
Nobody had, complete total shock. So Rob and our match, we successfully defended Southeastern belts against Bob Boy Frazier, Randy Rose, and Joe LeDuc got a tremendous welcome back in every arena we went to. Everywhere he wrestled Ron Bass, the matches ended up stopped for one reason or another. And it was going to be that way for a while with these two. They didn't like each other. Bob Armstrong was getting his Southeastern title shot, even though the Big C was still launching a complaint based upon what had happened on the last TV show. But that complaint was, based much more upon Bob Armstrong, the fact that Bob Armstrong won the belt that night. And the crowd went crazy in all those buildings.
Okay, so that's a great night for fans, absolutely. What about attendances in those three major markets?
Well, they were definitely not dropping any. I can tell you that in none of these towns. Joe LeDuc returning, that was always a good thing. Fans loved Joe at this point. And plus, there was a lot of interest in what was starting to happen in the junior heavyweight division. Montgomery added a couple hundred. They went from 4,500 to 4,700. Dothan added an extra 100. They went from 52 to 53. And obviously, Mobile was a steady sellout. I mean, it was always 5,600, and it was 5,600, all that would fit into the building.
It seems like every week now attendances are at record levels. Joe LeDuc was just returning after, I think you said, 10 weeks, and there was so much going on in the United States Junior Heavyweight Division. This has been another roaring studcast. The only bad news is we're not going to have enough time for a learning tree question today. You said something earlier about leaving a post on your social media sites for some suggestions from fans. Is this a good time for that? You want to talk about that now?
Yeah, it is, man. Before we end here, and thanks for reminding me. And I want to put up some posts basically on my Facebook sites, my Twitter, or X as it's called nowadays, for suggestions. Just comments from fans that something that I may be doing that they like, and something that I may not be doing that they would like for me to consider. So I just want to, I've never done it before, but I'd like to kind of hear from the fans and get their ideas of something maybe that I've never thought of. I want to keep improving the Studcast.
Wow. Okay. All right. So where are we going to be writing next week, Stud?
We're going to find out how they followed, man, this NWA world title card in Knoxville. Curious about how they're going to draw after this world title card. And we're going to have another hidden history lesson, taking fans behind the kayfabe curtain and opening eyes and covering up days and the day and back in the times when eyes weren't open and we were covering up the sport big time. So we're going to be talking about another good hidden history lesson. And then we're going to talk about the Southeastern Gulf Coast. We're going to be entering July 1980. It's the middle of the summer. Kids are out of school. Territories all over the world. We're doing big business. It was a great time of year for wrestling. And thankfully, we had a crew at this point. It was as good as any, man. And And we were doing as good as any for the size of our territory. We were keeping pace with a lot of the biggest territories in the country. And so hopefully we'll have enough time next studcast, maybe for another learning tree, too.
All right, good deal. All right, folks, you know how to get up with Ron. Find him at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, on Facebook. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. On Twitter, now known also as X, he's at Ron Fuller Welch on Twitter. You can follow him there. Check out the fantastic website. You know it, tnstud.com, tnstud.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. Shop the stud store where you get 43 super studcast, 4 different 8x10 photos, the thrilling lion novel called Brutus, personally autographed to you, by the way, and t-shirts still on sale for only $15.99, all with free shipping. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. It's Southeastern Rewind on YouTube. It's the first thing that comes up when you start putting in Southeastern on YouTube. Southeastern Rewind. Find hundreds of hours of classic old school wrestling entertainment, 431 total videos, the last 134 studcast, 16 Ask the Stud shows, and 115 short rides with the stud. Go back 1 year or more and discover fantastic stud stories about worldwide stars, 23 studcast archive stories, 23 Tell Me More fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and so much more. That's YouTube Southeastern Rewind. It's the best deal in wrestling. All right, any final comments, Stud?
I want to wish everybody a happy 4th of July. It's coming up now. Actually going to start tomorrow if you're listening the first day we drop this to the Studcast. And please be careful out there, everybody. I mean, it's a good time of year, and a lot of people out boating and doing whatever. Be very careful. And thanks for listening today. And hope you've enjoyed it. And take care of yourselves and others. And may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.